Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, Greg Everett in the house. This is episode 144 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Greg, what's going on?
Not much. Just getting here ready to hope that you have some good answers for these questions, because I most assuredly do not.
I'll make something good up. And Squatchy picked us a, he picked us a good round of questions, he did, that bearded maniac, so...
Yeah. Oh, I just see here number 9 is titled Joining the Circus. So God knows what that one's going to be about. You'll all just have to sit through all of this other stuff first.
What's the saying? I love the clowns, but I hate the circus.
Everybody loves a cane.
Oh, man.
That's a little bit of news radio humor for you. Joe Rogan would get it.
So what's new with you? What's cracking?
Man, nothing.
Nada.
We're just chipping away at the same old bunch of usual stuff. See, I feel like I'm just getting more and more boring by the minute.
It's called OLD in the words of Michael Rutherford.
Yeah, there's some of that, definitely. But I guess maybe qualifies as excitement around here probably doesn't seem so exciting outside of Catalyst Athletics.
Funny how that works.
Like getting new metal jerk tables and another pair of blocks.
Yeah. That's cool. I would be excited about that. But
so sweet.
Yeah, I would be excited about that. What's going on around these
parts?
So
you just wrapped up your AHS talk, getting prepared for that.
It is about 95% done. There will be a little tinkering and fiddling. Actually, when this thing goes up, I will be about 18 hours away from jumping on a bird and leaving Reno at like 4 a.m. to go to Boston and hang out with some folks. Going to see John Frankel, my old friend who's a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and a PhD from Harvard in Korean literature. And then
excellent.
I will see all of the other hooligans associated with AHS 2012. So looking forward to that.
Make sure you ask him for me how his sternum is feeling these days.
Wait, what happened to his sternum?
You remember Zach coming in and getting
right.
A little crazy?
That's right. I do remember that now. I do remember that. Super cool dude.
I remember you telling me a couple of years after that it was still causing him problems.
Yeah, it was not quite right. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Of course, mine's never been right since that three-day weekend of doing the jiu-jitsu seminar with you and Matt Thornton. I think you were laying, like, 235 or something, and Matt's, like, 275. And
Yeah,
I was broken after that. So
that, yeah. Well, I mean, I know how I felt after having Matt Thornton lie around on me. So
it was a grand
I can't
time.
Imagine how you felt.
It was a grand old time.
Oh, boy.
Well, hey, we're kicking off a new era in the Paleo Solution Podcast. Some folks have actually been foolish enough to want to sponsor us. And the first
Woo-hoo!
Person who jumped in is actually an amazing company, U.S. Wellness Meats. These guys have been around for ages. Like, they have been battling the good battle for a long time. They are a producer-owned grass-fed meat company. The cattle's raised from birth to processing, all in a natural open grazing environment. There's no hormones used. They are not certified organic, but that's largely because the whole organic processing thing is kind of nonsensical and dramatically increases the price. But they have a whole kind of biodynamic system going on there with a free-range poultry, pastured pork, all that good stuff. So super stoked that U.S. Wellness Meats has chosen to be our sponsor. For you all, the listeners, if you, over the next 2 weeks, like when this podcast goes up, you have 2 weeks, and if you order any order that you make from U.S. Wellness Meats, you'll receive a 15% discount if you put in the following: Paleo, the letter or the number 4, and then the letter U, Paleo4U. And so once this podcast goes up on Tuesday, Paleo4U will give you a 15% off discount on all purchases from U.S. Wellness Meats. And we'll have a link in the show notes to U.S. Wellness Meats. But Dr. Google can, in fact, track you down U.S. Wellness Meats reasonably easily.
Yeah, he's giving me the link right now so I can put it in the notes.
Perfect.
What a guy.
Perfect. So thank you again to U.S. Wellness Meats for sponsoring the podcast so that we can feed our hungry squatchies and Amy's and Steph's and all that stuff. So very cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It is cool.
Indeed a brave new world of podcasting.
I'm shocked that they were willing to do it, but they were. So we're super
Let's
excited.
Let's not talk them out of it.
yeah, totally.
All right.
So anything else? Do we just jump in on this? Is it that easy?
I say we jump right in.
Okay.
It's that easy. It's as easy as we want it to be.
I was going to have an easy analogy there, but I'll just keep all the wheels on the road for right now. So
yeah, we'll see. Hey, we got 9 questions. There's plenty of time to get start swerving off the road.
Perfect. Okay. Perfect.
All right. Jeremy says, Greg, are the new Reebok/CrossFit lifting shoes, which are supposed to be good for some things other than lifting, any good? Or is this type of dual purpose lifting shoe just snake oil? Many thanks to you, Yoda of lifting heavy things.
You're larger than Yoda. You would be more like the Chewbacca. Good they are not.
Honestly, I don't want to beat up on them too badly because I've only seen one person in my entire life use them. And I saw her for 2 days at a seminar. She didn't seem to really care one way or the other about them. But she was indeed a CrossFitter. So they were more appropriate for her than a weightlifter, obviously. For a weightlifter or someone who's going to take snatching and clean and jerking very seriously, I would not recommend them. And that's based on very little information, very little feedback from people who've actually used them. So take it with a grain of salt. But, you know, there's a reason that companies make legitimate weightlifting shoes.
Real specific shoes, yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
So what is the spec on them? Like they're mainly, like they've got a heel, I would assume.
It looks like they have a heel and it has that little zigzag thing on it. So it looks super awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But they look to me like they're just a little bit lighter weight and more flexible.
Gotcha.
Which lightweight is great. Flexible, I'm not a big fan. You want a fairly stiff, flat sole.
Right.
And when I say flat, I don't mean not a raised heel. I just mean a
not so flexible
one. Like right. The shoe needs to flex a little bit around the balls of the feet, you know, for the jerk and all that. But if it's just a squishy sort of, I mean, they look like slippers with a raised heel practically.
Okay.
So you're spending $150 on them. You can get a decent pair of Adidas shoes for $150 to $200. And if you're, you know, with the CrossFit workouts, honestly, I have said this a million times before, but I don't really like doing barbell Olympic lifts in conditioning workouts anyway. So that kind of makes the whole dual purpose shoe need a moot point anyway.
What is the situation though that you would be like, okay, we would use these shoes? Like I agree with you. I'm not super fired up about barbell complexes other than like the way that Javorek kind of laid these things out where it was, you know, kind of specific rep schemes,
We had that conversation. That's way different.
It's a totally different deal. Totally different deal. But what is a scenario in which someone might want these shoes? You know,
forget your other shoes.
Forget the legit shoes. So, you know, say you're doing a clean pull-up workout or a clean muscle-up workout.
They might be absolutely fantastic. But that said, if you're just doing pull-ups or muscle-ups or some non-foot-supported exercise in addition to the Olympic lift, then you can just use regular weightlifting shoes.
Okay.
So the only reason that comes to mind that you would really want a dual-purpose shoe is if you were combining it with something like running or, you know, something similar ground-based where you need to be a little more agile and have a little more flexible shoe. But then again, you run into the problem where because it's dual purpose, it's just not very good at anything.
Right.
Which I think is the basis of this question. It's kind of like, is there even a point?
So
and yeah, it's like a nice, it's a great theory. It would be nice to have a shoe that could really do it all. But I think that for the CrossFitter, I tend to just recommend people use a nice, thin, flat-soled, simple shoe. And I think they can get away with pretty much anything. And I think that's going to do better. That's going to be better for the running and these other things than this dual-purpose shoe will be good for the weightlifting stuff.
Because, like, the very – was it the very – not the first workout, because they had, like, the triathlon first, but they had, like, the track and field workout that was, like, some split snatches with some running and, like, some pull-ups or kettlebell swings or something like that. So, I mean –
you're going to spend for a split snatch. You really don't even need those things.
You don't need the heel. If it's power variance, you don't need it. Nails on the chalkboard. Everybody, cleans and snatches are the full variants. Saying squat clean and squat snatch is fucking broken. But anyway, as an aside, when I say clean and snatch, I'm assuming the full variants here. But here's one deal. If the loading is light, you know, like the way that they would normally run, say, like an Isabel or something, you know, if the loading's comparatively light, then that heel becomes way less of a factor. If you've got like an Isabel, you know, a running Isabel or something like that, where you're doing 400 meter runs or 200 meter runs in between, again, the loading is comparatively light, and you really want to play to what's going to be the longer portion of the activity, which would be the running. And so, I mean, I'm trying to figure out what would be a scenario in which some sort of a cross trainer shoe like with this would be appropriate. But if you have maximum loading, say like you're going to do some really heavy cleans, some really heavy snatches, and some muscle ups or something, then you would want to play to a regular Ole shoe because of the support it's going to provide in the upright torso and the better ground contact and all that stuff. So, I mean, it like I'm really trying to find something where we could make an argument on this
way harder than
I guess.
I guess I'm not that enthusiastic about it. I mean, to me, it's like you got your weightlifting shoes and then you got your everything else shoes,
right?
You know what I mean? And ne'er the twain shall meet.
Right.
I just don't see a need. I don't know. It just seems like one more thing to market to CrossFitters from Reebok, which of course it is.
And that, you know, I'm just trying to figure out, like,
Stand strong, CrossFitters.
Could you figure out a scenario in which this, you know, these guys would be appropriate? And I guess we're really legitimately coming up with probably not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, appropriate. Yeah. Ideal. No.
Gotcha.
Which is the whole point, is they're going to be suboptimal for every single thing you do. So I think, like you kind of said a second ago, is just figuring out what's the thing that's going to be the bulk of this workout, or that the shoes are going to affect the most.
So, like, you know, Ole shoes are pretty heavy. So, like, if you had a snatch or a clean combined with like toe to bars or pull ups or muscle ups or something, then you could maybe strategize, okay, it's not that heavy of loading, but my more upright position via this heel lift is going to give me a little bit better pull, a little bit better catch, so that's all good. But then when I get ready to do my gymnastics based deal or whatever, then I'm lugging around a couple of pounds less, particularly if it's out at the end of your lever, like you're doing a toe to bar or something like that.
Yeah, but I mean, good lifting shoes really aren't that heavy, though.
Right.
I mean,
maybe I'm just weak.
Well, I mean, like a good Adidas shoe is really not heavy at all, especially the newer ones.
I have some old Dewins, man, and they're fudging heavy. They're like, I could, you know, they're probably cloggers that would be like, yeah, your shoes are heavy, so maybe I just need to get something made in the 2010s.
I mean, like, really, the problem with using weightlifting shoes for things other than weightlifting is the fact that you do have a raised hard heel, and more, I think, really, is that the you have a really sharp edge around the sole of the shoe. And so, in other words, if you don't land with a flat foot,
you're going to roll.
It's really unstable.
Yeah.
And so when you're doing things like running or, you know, any kind of cutting motion or things that are kind of on an unstable changing base, you want the flexibility and I can't think of the word I want, but you just need a shoe that can
that's hold more up dynamic the landing than the
a little
shoes.
Bit, you know, differently constantly. So,
okay.
I don't know. I don't see a point, honestly.
I was working it, man, but we've spent 15 minutes on shoes.
I know, which is shocking. No, I really honestly thought this was going to be a 1 minute question.
I had to drag it out. So,
sorry. Oh man. Sorry. So yeah, give them a shot if you like them. But if you're thinking of buying them instead of weightlifting shoes, I would definitely not do that.
Okay.
I would just buy some weightlifting shoes and then anything other than toe shoes.
Cool.
All right. Julie says, Aloha, Rob and Greg. Love the cast and would love to hear your thoughts on DNA dictating our personal best workout, especially before any of us blindly plunk down $500 for the phenotype cheek swab test. Ouch. Please see below report and mahalo nuai for any insight you can offer, Julie. I'm sorry, I probably murdered that Hawaiian pronunciation.
I'm sure it was great.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's probably, if you've got, you know, some money burning a hole in your pocket, you could definitely do some genetic testing, and it'll give you a pretty good idea if you're more fast twitch or more slow twitch dominant, and that will give you some indication of what type of rep schemes that you could work in and get best effect. Pulikan, I think Pulikan's like the first guy that put the rep testing on my radar, and it was ages ago, maybe like a T-Nation article or something like that, but where, say, like you had bench press or back squat and you took 85% of your one rep max and then you just tried to get as many reps as you could on it. And somebody who is very, very fast twitch dominant, like a legit 100 meter sprinter, would only get like three, maybe four reps of 85% of their one rep max. Somebody who is much more intermediate twitch would probably be able to get like, you know, 8 or 12. Some people will get as many as 15 when they're more kind of low gear, slower twitch dominant. So you can figure some of this out just by kind of doing some weightlifting type testing. And also, I mean, to some degree, like, do you put on muscle easy? Are you real fast? Do you jump higher than the people around you? And if you don't, then you probably will do better being more, you know, depending on what your goal is. But my orientation is always kind of like the health longevity deal, which usually means adding some muscle mass and all that sort of jive. And so, you know, you probably will benefit from a little bit higher rep scheme. Not to say that you can't play around with the lower reps, but you will probably benefit from the higher rep scheme. We had a client who she made some pretty good progress in the gym, but not spectacular. And she was messing around with the Olympic lifting class, and you know, so a lot of what she was doing, like onesies, twosies, threesies, not a lot of volume, reasonably high intensity, and she just wanted like a rock hard butt. She actually wanted her legs a little bit bigger. She felt like they were a little bit flabby and droopy and everything. And then she did the 23andMe genetic testing, and she came back like double dominant slow twitch. Like, this chick does not have a fast twitch muscle even in her eyes. And so, you know, I suggest when we got this information, I suggested to our trainer that this gal start doing nothing really under 10s and more in the 12 to 18 rep range. And all of a sudden, like, she starts adding some muscle mass, her butt gets nice and kind of juicy and everything. And she had really good response to that. So, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's the first thing that kind of stands out to me in this question is, I mean, best workout for what? I mean, because your goal is going to be independent of your phenotype. You know what I mean? Like, what you're predisposed to being good at or what you're predisposed to responding well to is not necessarily the same thing that you want to do. You know what I mean? So if your goal is to just put on a bunch of muscle or to lean out, these more kind of aesthetic goals, then I think it's probably fairly useful. But if your goal is something very performance specific, then there are certain things in training that you're just going to need to do, whether or not they seem to suit you physiologically. You know what I mean? So like, if you say, hey, I want to snatch and clean and jerk as much as possible, but you're a slow twitch dominant person, it doesn't mean you're going to do snatches and clean and jerks for 15 reps. That might get you gigantic traps, which is pretty cool, but you know, it doesn't change the fact that in order to get good at snatching and clean and jerking heavy, you got to snatch and clean and jerk heavy.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So I'm sure there's some kind of balance point between those two extremes, obviously.
But like in, where, you say, know,
with like your accessory work, you can do more high volume.
Yeah, the accessory work, you might be a little bit more volume oriented. I know so, Dan John, who's got a good solid O-lifting background and everything, but when you poke around in his reading, one of his coaches at one time said that he should never go lower than 10s, or not never, but he should spend the bulk of his time in the 10s region on back squats. And you know, Dan's just kind of commented on this stuff that he's migrated down, he's played around, but then when he goes back to these, you know, sets of 10, that he seems to make the best progress. But then when he's doing Olympic lifts, he's doing singles, doubles, that sort of stuff. So, yeah.
Cool. All right. This is the world's longest subject line. N-acetyl L-carnitine and alpha-lipoic acid versus thyroid function. Ken says, based partly on the recommendation in your book, I recently started taking N-acetyl L-carnitine. I took it 3 times in the morning, and each time it knocked me on my ass. Zero energy. I felt like I couldn't get out of bed and had great difficulty maintaining focus on the simplest tasks. I did some research and found information indicating that NAC prevents T4 and T3 being taken up by the cells in the body and is for that reason used to help counteract hyperthyroidism. Looking a bit further, I found information that alpha-lipoic acid can also affect the levels of thyroid hormones in a percentage of people, specifically inhibiting the conversion of T4 to T3. This info kind of knocked me for a loop. Needless to say, I won't be taking any more carnitine, and we'll likely quit the ALA. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I
get my acronyms mixed up here like an asshole.
This was kind of news to me. Like this question put this on my radar. I was not aware of this. Digging around, there was a great review article from like 2004, 2005 that had, you know, like 50 citations talking about how wonderful N-acetyl carnitine was for a variety of metabolic situations. It's kind of conditionally essential under certain metabolic situations. And then the only real negative thing that I found in there was that there was the potential to block the T3, T4 uptake by cells. You need to be taking quite a bit of it, though. You need to be in the 2 to 4 gram per day for a while range. Like you need 6, 8, 10 days before you really start getting this type of effect. So this could be the deal, and it was kind of a similar deal with alpha-lipoic acid. It can be an influence in this, but it's at pretty high doses, and at the doses that high, alpha-lipoic acid has enough of a hypoglycemic effect. I think you'd be having, you know, like blood sugar crashes before you would ever be worrying about the thyroid stuff. So maybe this is why you were feeling lethargic after using it, but it seems really quick. And then also based off the amounts that are recommended in the book, it doesn't seem like this would be the thing that was doing it. Maybe it had some corn in it, and you're acting corn. I don't know. I'm guessing there, but you're absolutely correct that this can be a factor. But I would be surprised if this was the issue, given the amount that you're taking, based off the recommendations in the book.
Cool. Okay, gut healing protocol. Evan says, Robin, Greg, great show. You guys saved me from speeding with rage during my morning and afternoon commute. Used to be an unfortunate hour-long drive. Now it's actually not bad because of your show. So thank you very much for your time and effort. Well, you're welcome for the time. I can't say we put a ton of effort into it.
We can, though.
It's about as much effort as it takes to drive during that hour. My question is about gut healing protocol. I've heard you mention it several times in response to a multitude of questions, usually involving someone's intolerance to a paleo-esque food. Every time you've mentioned it, however, I've not heard you go into depth about what the protocol involves. I've read some things from Polican sites and other random sites, but still don't have a good idea of procedures. FODMAP seem to come up often, and I know your probiotic and super enzyme recommendation. I think he probably means the superfood enzyme. But what other protocols do you recommend if someone is feeling digestive discomfort even with paleo foods? Also, I have seen you say in the comments of your blog post that you may be doing a podcast on this soon. So in case soon has happened before this question is read by you, here's another quick one that I would love to hear your opinion on. What do you think of Paul Jaminet's article, The Trouble with Pork? Legitimate? Here's a link to the article. We did talk about pork fat.
Yeah, we've talked about that. So
2 ago.
Evan, we've talked about this stuff before, brother. You might just have to dig around in the archives a little bit.
Although people did seem not pleased with the pork answer.
No, that was, you know, it's really funny. Like I had a couple of people, you know, after I went on the Rogan gig and they were like, Rob, you're a fucking fraud for recommending bacon and eggs. And I'm all, so what? Please explain to me the biochemistry of why bacon and eggs are horrible. And it's just like, everybody knows they're bad. And I'm like, please, no emotional responses, just facts. And then, you know, it's just like, people just lost their minds. And then one guy was like, hey, Rob, what about eating the bacon and eggs and then finishing with a kale shooter at the end? And I'm like, sure, man, knock yourself out. God, like, why have either kale. Or? Just do both. So, yeah, and people were all spun up about the pork deal. I've talked to Matt Lalonde about this. The short, respectful answer is that I just disagree, and I really don't see a problem with pork. There are people who, because of systemic inflammatory issues, particularly related to gut health, which we'll weave back into this here in a minute, grain-fed animals can be gut inflammatory enough for some people that they have problems with them. So that's where like pastured pork and, you know, grass-fed meat and all that become necessary for certain people. I mean, the gut healing protocol gets a little bit nebulous because you have different situations. So it's a little bit of like a flowchart kind of gig. Chris Kresser has the personal paleo code, which I've got a link to in the store. And it's phenomenal. And it has the autoimmune protocol kind of detailed in there. When Matt Lalonde came on the podcast, what was it, like episode 68 or somewhere around there? But, you know, we really kind of delineated what went into this, which was, you know, the basic paleo protocol, no grains, no legumes, no dairy. And then for the autoimmune piece, we further add, you know, kind of curtailing nightshades, tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, nuts and seeds for the most part. Any type of vegetable that you eat, it should be peeled and cooked thoroughly. Probiotics are certainly something that should be utilized. And even within those, there's such a spectrum of probiotics. Some people do better with a bifidum. Some people do better with the lactobacillus. I've seen some people do really well with like the Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a beneficial yeast. Other people actually have like a anti-Saccharomyces antibodies, and they end up getting kind of puffy and bloated from even the S. boulardii. So, you know, it's all over the place. Like, there's not a 100% roadmap. And then, you know, the FODMAPs, these fermentable foods. Chris Kresser, just a day or two ago, had a great blog post on FODMAPs. So if you do a little Googling, Chris Kresser, FODMAPs, he did a great blog post on it, basically talking about what foods are high in these fermentable carbohydrates that can cause some gut irritation and which ones are low. And maybe not surprising, or maybe it is surprising, the things that seem to be better and easier for folks are things like cooked carrots, squash, yams, sweet potatoes, turnips. It ends up being carbohydrate sources that are actually a little bit more dense, you know, and easier to digest. And so that's part of the gut healing protocol. Interestingly, super high amounts of fiber are not good because fiber... do you remember Colon Blow from Saturday Night Live?
Super Colon Blow, yep.
It's equivalent to 10,000 bowls of fiber or whatever, you know, like barbed wire.
Phil Hartman was the guy in the straight man in that one. It's fantastic.
Oh, man. Genius. So you kind of want to limit your fiber. It's not to say you don't have any, but you kind of dial it down such that you have minimal GI symptoms, you know, gas, bloating, kind of loose stool, and then you can dial it up and see if you have some problems that come about from that. So, I mean, in big pictures, that's kind of the gut healing protocol. Chris Kresser's personal paleo code is very, very good at walking you through all that stuff. If you check it out, I would highly recommend it.
Cool. All right.
And we covered pork, so we're good.
All right here. It makes me sick when I shoot people. Okay. I guess he's not a sociopath. Nick says, greetings and salutations. First of all, I love your podcast. In Neverland, you guys would be my happy thought.
Nice. Scary, but nice. Man.
Second, been strict paleo for 2 years and feeling great, so thanks. I'm a combat search and rescue aerial gunner in the Air Force. The first thing I picture when I read this question is that scene in, oh my God, I just blanked on the name of the movie. It's like
Tropic Thunder?
No. The real one. With effing Matthew Modine in it, the Stanley Kubrick one.
Full Metal Jacket?
Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
Get some. All right. I fly 3 to 4 times per week doing high Yaka maneuvers. I don't know what the hell that is. Shooting guns and hacking the mish. My problem is that I become motion sick almost every flight. I hate puking every day like a bulimic model, but I love my job. I had accepted the fact that I would be sick till I retire. When one day I overslept, didn't get a chance to eat or bring food, and rushed into work. I was figuratively starving, and our flight got delayed. The rest of the crew ordered pizza to tide them over, so I cheated like Ashton Kutcher. The result? A zero nausea flight. It was fantastic shooting the 50 cal with no bubble guts. So what was the deal? I'm assuming the heavy bread load, soaked up all those stomach acids. What paleo-friendly food or supplement might duplicate this effect? I appreciate any insight. P.S. I apologize, Greg, for the grammar. I'm at the end of a 7-week bullwhip school, and my give a fuck is really low. Thanks for all you do for the universe. No problem.
I've actually researched motion sickness quite a bit because I used to not have it, and then when I was boxing, oh man, it was like 94 or something, I got an absolute bell ringer, and wasn't quite right for a couple of days, probably should have gone to the hospital, almost certainly some sort of a concussion, and ever since then, if I sit on a swing set, I go on a merry-go-round, I mean, I get motion sick really easily,
it's because you knocked your brain loose.
Yeah, and I could have, there are these little calcium jags that can exist in the eustachian tube, and those can get knocked loose and then slosh around when the fluid in your inner ear is sloshing around, and that can change some stuff. There's a lot in the literature actually indicating that too much sodium intake can worsen motion sickness. Ginger is really well studied in preventing motion sickness, but you've seemed to have discovered that pizza fixes it. So
between eating ginger and pizza, I know where I'm going.
Yeah. I mean, or you just have some, sashimi style pizza with some ginger on top or something. I don't know, but I wish I had something better here for Nick, but it's a head scratcher for me. Unless you've been eating paleo and maybe you've been low sodium, and then this meal, which would have a relatively high amount of sodium, we've talked about on the podcast before that sodium has a U-shaped curve with different disease states. Maybe at very, very low sodium intake, you get motion sickness. Maybe at a appropriate level of sodium intake, you have reduced motion sickness, and then maybe at high intake, you have increased motion sickness. That just occurred to me just now, and I haven't really researched that, so we can do a little doctor Googling on that later, but I don't know why. It's not from just soaking up stomach acids like that. That's definitely not it. There's something else going on here.
So I wonder what kind of a pizza was it? What was on it? Maybe he can deconstruct that pizza and try each ingredient at a time, leaving the bread out, see what happens.
Yeah. Unless it actually was the bread, which would, be interesting, a little bit heartbreaking, but kind of interesting. So, because the one thing that might fix my motion sickness, I would be shitting myself so bad from eating it. It would be reasonably off limits. I guess you could try to track down a gluten-free pizza and do the same experiment. And then, you're kind of narrow, and then you try nachos, and then you try a chili dog, and, just kind of bounce around the junk food scene.
I like this experiment.
Yeah, yeah. It's the Steve Pan mass gain and motion sickness study.
There you go. Perfect. All right. Difference between normal water retention and an inflammatory response. Elaine says, "Hi, Robin, Greg. Quickie question for you guys." Yeah, heard that one before. Both times I've gone strict paleo, usually after a bad food bender, I've lost about 4 pounds of water weight over the course of the first the first 24 to 48 hours. Sorry, I'm laughing because it says fist, and for some reason, I think I'm tired enough that that's hilarious. The next morning, the waist of my pants fits better, and my rings don't get stuck on my fingers. And, of course, the majority of my GI issues magically resolve. Is this simply a reaction to going low-carb, or could it be related to reducing inflammation by eliminating inflammatory foods? I suppose that I'm concerned that my dietary indiscretions are affecting me worse than I think, and what I pass off as a little bloating is more like inflammatory World War II decimating my innards. Thanks. Elaine from Reno. Welcome to the biggest little city, Rob.
Yeah. Stoked to be here. I was just thinking about your comment. So, on a non-systemic inflammatory side of things, like we can store, I don't know, depending on how large the person is, like 400 to 600 grams of glycogen between the muscles and liver. The glycogen can associate with, I think it's like each gram of glycogen associates with like 4 grams of water or something like that. So you could have several pounds of water floating around in you just associated with muscle and liver glycogen. So if you eat low carb for a couple of days, you deplete the muscle and liver glycogen, and you're going to diurese and shed some water from that. But, you know, maybe one of the indirect indicators or a dietary protocol that tells you when you've eaten enough carbohydrate or enough junk food, when people are doing cyclic low carb, like the classic Mauro Di Pasquale anabolic diet or metabolic diet, they will have you eat low carb for 5 days or 3 days or, you know, whatever the protocol is. Then you start eating carbs until you start gaining water and bloating. And this is neglecting like the effects of grains and gut irritation and all that sort of jive. That's just on the kind of insulin mediated inflammation, kind of aldosterone kind of gig. And then if you throw in gut irritation, then you could very, very quickly have an upregulation of inflammation from bad food and high carbohydrate, or a downregulation because of better food and lower carbohydrate. So it totally makes sense. And you know, it's a thing, again, where, like, if you know that you've got GI issues, when you know you have GI issues related to eating certain foods, we know that gluten is related to, like, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer, all kinds of things, all kinds of nasties. And so, it's kind of... Come on, Elaine. We got to hang together in Reno, so don't go off the rails. I'll take you out to Tacos El Rey, and we'll get a big seafood platter and forego the junk food. So
there you go.
Yeah,
I've seen that places. What is it? The chicken soup thing?
Yes,
that just has like a whole or a half chicken in it.
Yeah, dude. The chicken is still running around. Sometimes it's amazing.
Yeah. All right. This one is going to be tough.
Enormous.
So I apologize in advance. Celiac DNA testing. Robert says, Mr. Wolf, how very polite. I want to thank you for taking the time to read this and for all you have done in the paleo world. I've enjoyed listening to your podcast, read your book, and have been a fan ever since I first heard you speak during one of the first CrossFit radio interviews a few years ago, before the CrossFit cult became the People's Temple Part Deux. Oh, man. CrossFit Radio. Remember that?
The good old days. The salad years.
Yeah. My question concerns my wife. She's 26 years old and has had GI issues since birth. She had a colonoscopy at 16 and both an endoscopy and colonoscopy 2 years ago with negative biopsy results for celiac disease. She was found to have mild gastritis and treated for reflux with Nexium. She continued to have GI distress presenting as alternating bouts of diarrhea and constipation, gas, and pain, along with anxiety and depression episodes. Of course, the gluten hater I am suggested she change her diet when we met 3 years ago, but it wasn't until recently she got off gluten with dramatic improvement in all symptoms. When she had her recent upper-lower GI procedures, her lab tests were only a CBC and LFTs. No tests for serum antibodies such as anti-tissue transglutaminase antibodies, anti-gliadin antibodies, or deamidated gliadin peptide antibodies were done. Typical GI doc relying on biopsy results only. I'm sure you've heard this before. Her primary doc has agreed to a celiac panel serum, but I'm concerned that she may not show positive antibodies since she has been gluten-free for a few months. We are considering DNA testing for the HLA-DQ serotyping to try to confirm what we suspect is a gluten intolerance or full-blown celiac without visible villus atrophy.
Are you familiar with the DQ2 and DQ8 alleles as markers for potential development for celiac disease, and do you recommend this type of testing? I realize that if one has the genetic potential for development, that it is not the same as diagnosis, and even with a positive DQ2 or DQ8, she may not have celiac disease, but her remarkable improvement led me to believe that she is gluten intolerant. Our concern is for our children and their potential for development of gluten intolerance / celiac. I understand you are a very busy person, and please don't feel any obligation for a response. Also, congrats on becoming a father recently. There really is nothing like having children to make one understand conditional love. Thanks for everything.
Woo! Woo! That was a marathon just in the telling right there.
Yes.
So, you know, Cyrex Labs has some pretty good, seemingly, like, I'm kind of banking on the... their promotional material claiming the ability to find gluten intolerance and celiac diagnosis much more keenly than the standard test that you would get from your GI doc. You know, I am familiar with the DQ2 and the DQ8 alleles, and I think what you find, it's kind of like they have the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genotypes which relate to breast cancer, and not everybody with those genotypes get breast cancer. Not everybody with breast cancer has those genotypes. And so it's kind of helpful, but, you know, it's much more compelling to just simply understand that it's very, very rare that I find somebody who does not improve by removing gluten from their diet. And it sounds like your wife has done that. The standard blood work that your doc is proposing to do, if she hasn't been eating gluten, she's not going to react because probably the titer of the antibodies has dropped off. So then they recommend that you eat gluten so that you can get good and sick to be able to prove what you already know experientially. So, you know, I know the kids are involved and all that sort of jive. The way that we're going to navigate this, thinking like 50 different things here. I have never
use your
come
words,
up,
Robbie.
Use your words, Rob. I have never come up positive on a biopsy or on the standard blood work for celiac. But I mean, I am explosively reactive to gluten, which maybe it's not exactly celiac. Although I end up having like kind of neurological effects and everything, so it seems more than just what they're categorizing as gluten intolerance versus the actual celiac disease and whatnot. So, I mean, you could go for it. It might tell, you know, if she pops up a positive on these alleles, then you guys, you know, you will have more leverage and she will feel more comfortable pulling this stuff out. You might feel like you're a little more justified in trying to forego your kid's exposure to gluten. I don't know. I mean, again, we just see so many people benefit so much from taking this approach that I'm kind of at a loss, you know, just simply removing this stuff and seeing how you look, feel, and perform seems to be so much more effective than just relying on the blood work. But again, Cyrex Labs is out there. For whatever reason, they've chosen not to create a direct-to-consumer interface. I really tried to do it, and they are a little bit hoity-toity about the whole thing and only want to go to practitioners, but then they're slow as molasses getting practitioners educated, so you can't actually find anybody to dispense their fucking tests. So
it's like
the best thing in the world, and you can't get to it. So I don't know what to tell you on that other than maybe pinging Cyrex and telling them to kind of get a little bit of a clue and make this thing more direct-to-consumer. So... That's what I got on that. Greg, any thoughts?
Are you serious? I have thoughts, but they would be
not related to
unrelated
that at all.
And unhelpful.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Adam says, well, since this starts off with such an odd sentence, I guess I should read the subject line. G6PD deficiency. Adam says, also known as favism. I have G6PD deficiency to some degree, at least enough for the U.S. military to detect it while I was in boot camp. Is this a mutation? How would you modify the paleo diet, if at all? I read somewhere that it interferes with the catabolism of carbs. Is this true? Could you shed some light on this subject? Thanks. Just finished week one of your diet plan.
Nice. So The G6PD deficiency is glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency, and it's a genetic disease which is related to the pentose phosphate pathway, and this ends up impacting erythrocytes, and it's another one of these heterozygote advantages. Stéphane Guyonnet had a great paper where he talked about the various advantages that have developed in our genome, largely dealing with infectious disease. And so there are different conditions like sickle cell anemia, where if you are homozygous for sickle cell anemia, the way that your red blood cells change in shape make you very resistant to malaria, but they tend to make you very dead also because they tend to get jammed into the small arterioles, and you get clotting and have a lot of problems. You have some hemolysis type problems too. So if you are a heterozygote, if you only have one of the genetic copies for this condition, for sickle cell anemia, then you have a little bit of problems with the way that your red blood cells fold and stuff like that, but you are reasonably well protected against malaria. So there's kind of a trade-off there. And these conditions are endemic in the Middle East and Africa, and seem to have been developed relatively recently in history when we started developing agriculture and blocking off waterways and creating more tasty habitat for mosquitoes. And this condition, the glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency, is another one of these adaptations which helps people to deal with malaria. So depending on where you are on the spectrum, this can be more or less severe. And so you could get some genetic testing to kind of delineate what the story is with that. I don't know that high carb or low carb is really going to be that big of a deal, given that this is actually related to the pentose phosphate pathway. It's interesting. You might benefit from a little supplementation with ribose, which is a pentose sugar. Carlson Labs and some other places manufacture that. I would do a little poking around just to run that by like a genetic counselor or whatnot, but that could actually be a way to circumvent that whole process. So that's what it is. I don't know that being low carb would necessarily be advantageous. It might be, but definitely ribose could be of benefit. And this overall means that if you and I went into malarial infested swamps, I would probably die and Adam would probably not.
Well, good to know.
There you have it.
If you're ever in that very specific situation. All right. You ready for this last one?
Oh, man. Let's wrap it up. Wrap it up with the circus.
Exactly. Max says, "Hey, Rob and Greg, I'm auditioning for circus school in February, and I'm trying to figure out how I want to train to prepare for it. The stuff that I do involves some intermediate-level tumbling and a lot of partner acrobatics. I'm a base in partner acro, so I've got to be strong and stable in order to effectively support and manipulate the person I'm holding up. My training has mostly been from Coach Summer's book, but I just bought Greg's book because I want to add in some O-lifting to get that ridiculous amount of power and speed I see these guys having. Now to my question. The circus schools to which I'm applying look at strength in two ways. One, max chins, max push-ups, no more than 35. That's weird. Max legs lift, or leg lifts, toes to the bar. And two, physique. I would like to get my chins and leg lifts up into the 20s by February. My push-ups are fine. And I'd like to drop a couple body fat percentage points by then. How would you suggest that I train leading up to this? I'm 5'10", 20 years old, 165 pounds, 10% body fat, been paleo for 1.5 years. I do cheerleading at the collegiate level in addition to the gymnastics body stuff. I don't want to sacrifice too much strength to get this endurance, and I don't want to sacrifice too much performance to get lean. I went ketogenic for 3 weeks a few months ago, and I looked pretty ripped, but my performance wasn't as good. I know I'm trying to have my cake and eat it too, but any thoughts you guys would have would be awesome. You guys are the most knowledgeable goofs on any podcast I've listened to, so thanks for all the info."
No, we do what we can. We try to be the most knowledgeable goofs that we possibly can aspire to. So
I don't really have to try that hard to be a goof.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
It comes naturally to me too. Though. Not too hard. I don't want to wear myself out.
It's true. It's true.
It is Friday.
So we're talking about basically chins and leg lifts here, it sounds like, because he's got the push-ups kind of squared away. I would just kind of do grease the groove on this stuff, which Pavel always had a cool formula, which was say like your max pull-up is 20 pull-ups. Try to do sets of around 10 to about half your max as much as you can throughout the day, and then just build volume and then retest. And I think that you can build up to some pretty ridiculously high strength endurance numbers by doing that. Like you could, when I was doing a lot of stuff like this, I was at a 28 like non-kipped pronated, so a pull up, not a chin, and clavicle touching each time, which is pretty solid.
You always did like that clavicle touching, didn't you?
When in Rome, as it were. I think, doing grease the groove on chins throughout the day and just kind of, like every third day, cut your volume in half on that. Maybe 2 days a week, do a strength-oriented chin kind of deal. Maybe you do practice some one-arm chins. Maybe you do some weighted pull-ups. Maybe you do some weighted chins. It's somewhere in like the, three rep range, real heavy, long rest period. So that's very, very different than what you're doing on the strength endurance side. And then there was a recent article on ketogenic diets and rhythmic gymnasts. And they found that after a 6 week adaptation period, that their performance was just as good as a non-ketogenic diet, and that their body comp was better. So again, depending on, you need to allow some time for adaptation, and then depending on the activity that you do, rhythmic gymnastics doesn't have quite the same kind of high-end power demands that you would see in, say, like a floor routine kind of gig, which I would find it hard to imagine that you wouldn't see a power drop-off for, like, standard gymnastics passes and stuff like that, because the floor routine ends up being reasonably long and a good amount of volume work. But rhythmic gymnastics is a little bit different. So depending on what you're doing for the circus, I could see the ketogenic deal being a way to drive the boat. Obviously, ketosis is not the only way to lose body fat. Wellborn has kind of bantied this around of 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight. Set calories at about 15 to 16 calories per pound of body weight, and then add carbs and fat to meet your calorie allotment based on your training needs. So if you're doing a lot of volume of training, then you have a little bit more carbs. If you're doing less volume of training, then you have less. But the fundamental deal there is that you've got adequate protein to prevent catabolism. You might even think about putting 4 doses of 10 grams each aliquot of a branched chain amino acids, so like 40 grams a day total of branched chain amino acids into that mix to prevent any type of catabolism or try to minimize it. And then you're just in a mild calorie deficit, and you do your regular training, try to get big and strong while losing a little bit of body fat and leaning out. And you, if you do that and you've got a very flat trajectory on this, and you're not trying to lose, say, like 10 pounds in 2 weeks, then you can chip away at this and should make some pretty good progress. Martin Burkham of Lean Gains has kind of made this comment that he knows that people are on a sufficiently modest calorie restriction if they are able to begin losing body weight, but the maxes that they are playing with are maintained. And so then we're assuming that we're not really losing much, if any, muscle mass. And that seems like a pretty reasonable idea.
I like it. I'm cool. A big fan.
Cool.
The one other thing you might look into is Ethan Reeves' density training for the pull-ups and the hanging leg raises. Good stuff. It's essentially kind of a grease the groove sort of thing, but with more of a planned progression.
I would, even though you're not being tested, obviously, on the, Twinkie hugs or reverse hypers or whatever, I would do equal volume of, glute ham back extensions or Twinkie hugs just to balance that out. Like, you do not want to become completely, so-as hip flexor dominant dude. Like, you can develop some problems with that. So I would do equal volume of back extensions, and it'll give you big, gnarly spinal erectors also.
Indeed. I like it.
Sweet.
Is that it? We done?
Yes, that's it.
There's just nothing left to say, is there?
Well, I'm cool with that.
We talked about everything from circus school to motion sickness and shooting people from helicopters. I mean, that's pretty incredible.
We kind of covered it all.
Yeah.
And what we didn't cover, I guess we'll get next time. So
there you go. All right.
Sweet. All right, G. Well, have a good weekend. I'll see folks at the Ancestral Health Symposium in Boston. And we'll talk to y'all soon.
See ya.
All right. Later, man.